Okay, so I would like to introduce Stacy, who is our speaker this afternoon. Hugh wasn't able to make it for various reasons, and so Stacy has gracefully stepped in on short notice to be our speaker this afternoon. Stacy is a really good friend of mine. I've known her since she's been in the DA program, and she's her life has turned around 360 degrees. She's such a different person than when I first met her, and as the result of her working the DA program. So everybody, please welcome Stacy. Yay, Stacy.
Thank you, Tish. Hi, I'm Stacy. I'm recovering from depression. Grateful to be here today. And I feel like I'm in a room of people who know me and love me and support me. And that's just all due to this program, which is amazing. And also, I got to say, my mom is here. She is listening into this meeting. Mom, you're getting thumbs up because this is her first time using Zoom. So that's going to be an experience. She's heard me speak before at other 12-step ventures, but this will be a first one. And it'll probably be painful because a lot of my life, like Tish just mentioned, when I came into this program, I was a mess. So I will get started. You know, I, like a lot of us have shared today, I had those strong feelings of rejection when I was a child. And for me, it didn't stem from, I didn't have childhood neglect. I didn't have these horrible things happen to me as a child. It just seemed to be an internal thing. I felt rejected. I never felt good enough. Even as a young child, I was a perfectionist. Apparently, I would like do a school project and rip it up because it wasn't perfect and redo it. And even though I got awards and I was getting good grades, I had this internal sense of I'm not good enough. And in fact, the first time I went into the hospital, I was 16. Well, let me back up a little bit. Yeah, so these feelings of not good enough and rejection, it's like, what did I do with them? I turned to food. Food was my first addiction. And because I was a performer, I was on the dance team in Color Guard in high school. I had to look good, right? I had to look a certain way. So I was afraid to gain weight. So I turned to purging. So bulimia was, I had an eating disorder. And that really catapulted the depression and the self-hatred and the shame. The shame was so intense. I just absolutely hated myself for what I was doing. I was afraid to admit it. It took me to really dark places. And finally, I felt like the weight of everything just collapsing in on myself. And I don't know how old I was, 14, 15, 16, something like that. I laid out in the snow in my house, in the backyard, waiting to die. A suicide attempt, sort of. A call for help, really, was what it was at that age. And that was my first trip to the psych ward. And that was when the doctor said to me, well, the textbooks say that if you have an eating disorder, it's because of this childhood trauma or this childhood trauma. And I'm looking at my past and I'm like, well, that's not me. So what's wrong with me? So yet again, that whole experience reinforced this idea that there's something inherently flawed about me. What is wrong with me? I don't know, but here I am. I'm 16. I'm in a psych ward and all my friends are out there having fun. And this doctor and I was like, can I get out in time for the school dance? You know, and he laughed at me. He actually laughed at me. This dude was on my first resentment list. Let me tell you, he laughed at me and said, no, you've got a lot of problems. You're going to be in here for a while. And my parents said, the heck with that. They pulled me out of there. And none of us understood that depression was going to be something I was going to be living with. I'm 45 now, you know, it's been an evil and corroding thread, as the literature talks about, throughout my life. But anyways, so that was my first trip to a psych ward, my And that started the journey of therapy and medications. And I don't want to dismiss that. At the time, I wasn't serious about it. I was in therapy because I was told I needed to be, and I just wasn't ready to address all these issues, you know? So went my high school career, and at some point in there, towards the end of that and beginning of college, I found alcohol. And once I got to college, I found other substances, and I found that those things helped me deal with those, you know, those problems, these feelings of rejection and not good enough and being socially awkward and all that stuff. And I'm an alcoholic. I'm in recovery 12 years now. No, 14. I can count. 14 years. For me, I was an alcoholic from the first time I took a drink. You know, I have that ism. I have that addictive personality, like other people have talked about, more, anything to get me out of myself, right? So I started going down that road. And when I got to college, and again, I was a really good student. I was like in the top 10% of my class, went from going to straight A's to my first semester in college, majoring in those other substances, and failing out of my first semester at college, which was a huge disappointment for my family, for me. And I came home and I crashed and burned, and I just like collapsed in tears and told them what was going on at college, which was other substances. And it got all blamed on my roommate. You know, it wasn't my fault. It was this girl who corrupted me, innocent child. You know what I mean? What was going on there was me neglecting responsibility. And that responsibility word, I used to call it the R word because I didn't even want any part of the word responsibility. So that is kind of a theme in my story too. And the next several years were just a blur of alcohol, other substances, food, purging, blackouts, being in and out of college. I would be functional for a while. I would go to college. I would do great academically. And then it would just pile up and I wouldn't be able to handle it. And I would get suicidal again. And I would end up in a mental institution or just withdrawing from college. And that cycle was horrible. And I pushed my friends away. I pushed my parents away. I pushed everybody who loved me away. There were things I was hanging on to though. I mentioned in high school, I was a member of like a color guard and a dance team, and I used to coach that. And that was something I was extremely passionate about and really loved. And so I was doing that for other high schools during my periods of functionality. And as I was working, you know, there were times when the depression got so bad, I just couldn't show up to practices. And I ended up letting a bunch of girls down that I really cared about. And that was something that really, really hurt me deep down inside. And, you know, that Dorothy Rose says one of the main ideas of depression, or one of the main things we believe, is that bad things happen to us in the past, therefore bad things will happen to us in the future. And that got like, that experience got cemented into me. And so that thought that, oh, I let people down in the past, I lost this job because of depression, I hurt everybody I cared about, I'm going to do that again in the future. So that stayed with me. And that was something that was hard for me to get over. But anyway, so this blur of psych wards and suicide attempts and mental institutions, that was my life for a while. I finally got sober for the first time in 2004. I ended up living in the Salvation Army for about 3 months. And if you're from another country and don't know what that is, it's like a step up from a homeless shelter. But it was specifically for people who needed help, either getting sober or with other addictions. And that was a huge turning point in my recovery, getting sober. I needed to do that. And you know, for a while, things were really good. I still had food issues, but the depression seemed to lift because I was doing better. I was able to go to college. I was actually able to graduate from college down there with a bachelor's degree. And I started working, but depression is still coming and going. This entire time, I'm still on medications. I've been on medications on since I was 16, on different ones. What would happen was, well, of course, I've had a slew of diagnoses, you know, major depressive disorder, bipolar 2, which is just the depression and then the lows, and then treatment resistant depression and other things. And so medications, I try one, titrate up, that would work for a while and it would stop working, and then switch to something else. And so I've been on around the medication circuit. I've done different therapies. I was in a DBT therapy group once, which was like an all-day thing for several months. And I went to live with my grandma because my mom couldn't handle living with me anymore. She just didn't know what to do with me. And I made it miserable for her to have me there. Anyways, so I'm in Indianapolis. I'm getting sober. I'm still got depression. It comes and goes. And I meet somebody at an AA meeting. Mental note, this is not the best place to meet guys, but you know what I mean? It happens. ended up being my daughter's father. So I'm pregnant. I decide that the best thing for me to do is move back home because I want to raise the baby around my mom and my dad. So I came back here, and while I was pregnant, I had an absolute horrible pregnancy. I went through severe depression during the pregnancy. I was in intense physical pain, and I remember sitting there just, I had one of these IV tubes. I had a pole that I had a PICC line attached to me. It was not a good physical situation or mental. And then you move me from my regular AA home group up to a new location. And here's me. I expect everybody that I don't know to come to my rescue, to take care of me, because again, I don't want to be responsible for myself, right? If I'm being responsible, I'm going to meetings. I'm saying, you know, this is what I need to do to take care of myself, but I'm not doing that. I'm expecting you to come rescue me. And how did that work for me? It didn't work very well. So I became very severely depressed. And during that time, I felt like my higher power was just kind of taking care of my child. Like it was just putting this shell of love and warmth around him because I was not taking very good care of myself. I was just a mess. And I've struggled with the idea of a higher power. When I first came into the rooms, I didn't have any God growing up. I was an atheist. That's how I was raised. And so it was hard for me to come to the idea of a higher power, but people told me, you know, you can use the rooms. And that was that clicked with me because a group of people recovering from depression was more powerful than I was. And so I used that as my higher power. And then it evolved from there. And like, I like to say the higher power of my non-understanding, because whatever my higher power is, I don't think I'm capable of comprehending that greatness. And I don't know exactly how I define it. And I'm okay with that today, but I do know it's working in my life. Like I can look back at my history and see that. And that's amazing. So I get through this pregnancy. She's amazing. She's a beautiful child. She's a child of God. I had this God moment where I'm like, okay, I did not create this child. This is something that my higher power did. You know, I can't be like, zoop, okay, life, there you go. You know, like this is evidence of my higher power. And yeah, and so she's amazing. And I'm so blessed to be a mom and to be able to have custody of her still. So I start working again. I start my career. I was a chemist and things were going well for a while until again, the depression comes back and it starts so subtly for me. Like, you know, it's hard to get out of bed sometimes, And then I call off work, and then can I go to work or can I not? I don't know. I'll make up an excuse. I can't be honest. I can't say, oh, I'm feeling depressed, because I'm too ashamed to admit that. So I'm physically sick. I was physically sick a lot. You know what I mean? Or so I said, because I had those days where I just couldn't get out of bed and couldn't go to work. And that was a depression. So I actually got laid off of that job. The company got acquired. I ended up going to grad school. And somehow I made it through grad school, got my master's degree. And again, depression is in and out, and then at some point it started getting really severe. I think it was after I graduated. And I remember I'm sober now, I'm in the rooms, I'm active in 12-step programs, I'm doing work in the steps, doing recovery, doing the deal, yet I'm still feeling severely depressed. And so that thing of like, what is wrong with me is still going on. They're to the core, that I'm not good enough, what's wrong with me? So intense in my core. So the last option that I had was to try ECT. And I ended up having, over a span of, I don't know, 6 or 8 years, probably 6 sessions of 8 to 10 ECTs each. And I say maybe because I don't know, because it's a blur, because I have a lot of memory loss because of those ECTs. And it's hard for me to talk about, but it's easier to talk about it today than it was, because I had so much shame about that, so much shame about getting that. And I can share that today. So, and that's because of this program. But I'm getting to that halfway point, and I haven't reached DA yet, so I want to get there. So, so ECT is electroconvulsive therapy. It is where you get, for lack of a better term, electricity shot through your brain in order to attempt to kind of reset your neuronal pathways. And it's statistically, somebody just asked in the chat what that was. The research shows that it's one of the most successful treatments for depression, but it has a lot of side effects, and it's not something they immediately treat you with. It's kind of a last resort treatment. So I had tried ECT several times and the depression kept coming back. I tried different medications. I tried ketamine. I was in a ketamine, clinical study. And that worked for a little bit, and then it stopped working again, like most things. And then it became to the point where I found myself becoming addicted to that. And I said, no, I can't do this. I got to stop. So my point is, like, I tried everything. And my psychiatrist even wanted me to do this invasive brain therapy thing where they put an electrode in your brain. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. Can't I just work the steps for depression? Why can't there be something like that out there? And I had a sponsor that was like going to take me through the steps for depression, but she never had depression. And finally she's like, well, I can't do this. You know, I haven't had this experience. And I'm thinking, what the heck? Why can't somebody just help me? You know? And so in one of those, and I want to explain to you guys too, like, I'm on disability for depression. Okay. This is where I was at that point in my life, because I was unable to work. I could barely get out of bed. There were days I couldn't get out of bed. There were days that my mom had to come and help take care of me and my daughter. My daughter's father's got a lawsuit against me for basically trying to prove I'm an unfit parent because of depression. So I'm fighting this lawsuit. I'm going through the disability thing. And I'm trying my hardest to be the best mom I can, because she's all I care about in this world. And I don't want her to live with her dad, because he's a worse off case than I am. So that's like my mental status. And I'm at the end of my rope. I'm in so much pain, emotional and physical pain, and I'm hopeless. And I'm resigned to the idea that I'm just going to live in an institution for the rest of my life, because there's something so wrong with me that I don't know, that nothing can fix it, right? There's no medication, there's no treatment, nothing is fixing me. So finally I find Depressed Anonymous online and I call a number and I actually talk to Hugh, and I'm in this very room. I'm crumpled in a ball on the floor in tears, telling him like, this is it. Like, I've tried everything else. There is nothing else that is going to work for me. I have no hope. What the heck am I going to do with my life? And he told me a little bit about himself. And he told me that there is hope and that there is a program for people like me and that, you know, there is a recovery community. And hey, there's a book called Depressed Anonymous and there's a workbook and you can work the steps for depression. And there's people that are going to understand. And there's meetings. There's a meeting. At the time, there was a Skype meeting. And so I went there and I ordered the book and I ordered the literature. And I was like, I found the meetings and people were talking my language. They understood depression. They've been where I've at. And I was like, oh my God, maybe there is hope. I was so afraid to hope. You know what I mean? Because I had let people down so many times in my life. I'd let myself down so many times, but like the tiniest sliver of hope was there and it just started growing. And COVID happened and then we started having meetings every day, which was awesome. And somebody's like, Stacy, you should chair a meeting. And I said, whoa, I'm the girl that can't show up for anything. You know, it all depends on how I feel on this given day. I can't make commitments. I can't do that. Why don't you just try one day, you know, and if you can't do it, that's fine. We'll back you up. I'm like, okay. And that's how I got started in service. And I showed up and there were days that I didn't and people covered for me and it was okay. I wasn't crucified. I was still kept in the rooms, you know, and that was a huge baby step for me. And I love the phrase baby steps because that's how my recovery is. That's how it started. It started with me getting out of bed, with me getting dressed for the day, with me going on a 5-minute walk. I remember reading in the literature, they say walk 5 miles a day. I was like, okay, I can walk 5 minutes a day. I can do that. And that's where I started because that's where I was at. And that was okay. That was what the start I needed. But I started chairing meetings. From there, it went into getting into service. That gave me a sense of purpose, a sense of accomplishment. I don't want to say accomplishment yet. Maybe just a sense of like, maybe I have a little bit of something that is capable inside of me. Because I felt that core of I'm not capable and I'm not worthy. So it started there. And then honestly, it started getting better. I was reading through the book. I got a sponsor. I was working through the workbook. I was doing the steps. And that whole process made me start to look at depression differently. The whole, okay, I'm saddening myself. I wanted no part of that in the beginning because I'm like, there's no way. You mean I have a part in this depression? Screw you. But the more I looked at it, it's true for me. It is. For me, I believe that I do have a chemical imbalance. I have a thinking disease, whatever you want to call it. I'm powerless over my first thought, but I do have a choice over my second thought and my first action. I love that. I absolutely love it. For me, my recovery is like a jigsaw puzzle. Medication is a piece of that jigsaw puzzle. I need it. DA is a big piece of my recovery. It's like the foundation. It's like the center of the jigsaw puzzle. It has a lot of pieces in it. And those pieces involve showing up to meetings, doing the steps, doing the work, connecting to other people. There's a lot of pieces in the DA piece. And then there's my higher power. I have to have a higher power. I have to have connections to other people because I was such an isolator. I pushed everybody away. I withdrew. These are all the pieces in the puzzle that is my recovery. And that's just for me. It's just what I found that works for me. And I'm so grateful that something is working right now. So there's a couple other things I want to get to. So recovery, and then like I don't even have time to tell this story, but after I'm in DA, I fall, I have a concussion, I have this major, huge setback. I'm actually in the psych ward again after I got home to DA for the first time, which was in 2019. And all my medications got screwed up. I was very mentally unstable, but I came back and I continued to do the work and I got better. So like one of my other favorite sayings, recovery is not a straight line. It's a squiggly line that goes up and down and sideways and around and wherever it goes. But it, as long as you keep on that, as long as I keep on that path, it keeps going up. So yeah, DA has really turned my life around. And finally, I got to the point where I thought I can maybe start working a little bit. So I started substitute teaching just like one day a month. And a couple days or, you know, a couple months later, it was a couple days a month. And I did not like substitute teaching. I did not like dealing with these kids. I had a big fear of it, but I did it anyways, because I thought it was a good stepping stone for other things. And I'll tell you this story real quick. I'm working with my sponsor. I've got a therapist. Meds are good. Things are good. I'm wondering, am I ready for full-time work again, you know? And so I'm sitting down one day. I was actually substitute teaching. I had a free period. I took my notebook. I'm journaling and I'm talking to God. I'm journaling to God. And I'm like, okay, God, I think I'm ready for the next step in whatever that is. I think I'm ready to work full-time. I don't know. I've got fear. I don't know. I'm going to trust you. My sponsor tells me to just trust the path, trust the process. I'm like, and I'm spilling out my feelings to God. I swear to God, this happened. That same day, I get a call from a job recruiter. I have not got a call from a job recruiter in like 3 years. Get a call from a job recruiter saying, you know, we've got this opening in the chemistry field and I found your resume and I think you'd be a great fit for the position. Would you like to come in and interview? I'm like, excuse me? You know what I mean? And I kept telling my sponsor, jobs just don't fall out of the sky. And then I had this experience. And so that started me on the path of interviewing. And I ended up finding this position, which I actually got. I got a full-time job and I was able to get up. And like, I've been there for almost a year and a half now. I haven't had a problem getting to work. That's a miracle. I haven't had a problem getting out of bed. That's a miracle. I say I'm going to go there and I do it. That's a miracle. And I have gone to work and I've screwed up and I've made mistakes and that's okay. I have learned to accept that I can make mistakes and that's a miracle, because I was, perfectionism is a huge character defect for me. And God has given me the opportunity to work on that. And oh boy, is he giving me the opportunity to learn how to ask for help, because I did not know how to do anything when I got to that job. But I'm so grateful. And my sponsor taught me how to do that too, taught me how to ask for help, because I had to do that. So that has just been a whole huge journey. And then after I was there for, I don't know, maybe 6 months, my boss, or maybe a couple months, my boss said, well, I'm going to retire. And I'm the lab manager at this company. So, Stacy, I think you should apply for this position. I'm like, what? So, and that's a whole lot of that R word. That's a whole lot of responsibility. You know what I mean? And I was so scared. And, but I did, because the program teaches me to just show up. And I, long story short, I ended up getting the job and, I'm still there. They haven't fired me yet. in fact, I'm doing really well at my position, and that's a miracle. But here's the thing. Before I was able to get this job, and I'm off of disability now, so that's really awesome. I've transitioned off of disability. I'm now self-supporting once again. I had to come to the point in my recovery where I felt like I was okay with who I was as a person before I was able to get this job. And I think my higher power did this for me. you know, because I had to believe that I was okay as a person. I didn't need a job title to define me. And in the past, I needed that. I felt like I was unacceptable because I was on disability. I should on myself a lot. I love that phrase. I should have this job because I have this degree. I should be this point in my life because my friends are, you know, this person I grew up with has a house, they have a job, they have a career. What's wrong with me? I should be somewhere else. I was always comparing myself. And so, but recovery gave me the gift of being able to accept myself where I was and understanding that I had worth and value as I was. I didn't have to have a job in order to have worth and value. I didn't have to have a job in order to learn how to have fun again. That was a huge thing in recovery. I had no idea how to have fun. I started being creative. I'm wearing one of the necklaces that I made during COVID. I made jewelry. I started crocheting. I learned how to do those things. And I found fun with those things. So I also do escape rooms. I find those to be very fun. Today I work out. I am a serious weightlifter. I may not look like it, but I'm currently squatting 150 pounds and deadlifting, sumo deadlifting 200. Those are my PRs right now. And I'm, yeah, I know it's crazy. But I find joy in that. And it's something that clears my mind and gets all the junk out of it. So it's helping me a lot. I think it's important for me to do in my recovery as well. And so I know I'm running out of time, but I want to share this with you. So every morning I have a call with, I call her my sister in sobriety. We talk for like 15 minutes and then we do some meditation readings. And I can read as Bill sees it because we read the disclaimer at the beginning of our meeting. So I can read from this. And this just happened to be today's reading. It's called A Way Out of Depression. During acute depression, avoid trying to set your whole life in order all at once. If you take on assignments so heavy that you are sure to fail in them at the moment, then you are allowing yourself to be tricked by your unconscious. Thus, you will continue to make sure of your failure. And when it comes, you will have another alibi for still more retreat into depression. In short, the all or nothing attitude is a most destructive one. It is best to begin with whatever the irreducible minimums of activity are. Then work for an enlargement of these day by day. Don't be disconcerted by setbacks. Just start over. And that was from a letter in 1960. And I read that this morning and I'm like, I love this because that to me says baby steps. Start with the bare minimum of activity. For me, that was getting out of bed. Man, I didn't know how to do that. You know what I mean? There were days that I just couldn't do that. But that's where I started. And then it went to like, you know, move to the couch. And from there, it was like, get dressed, take a shower, not all in one day, mind you, you know, this might take a month for me to get there because I had to do the bare minimum of activity. And this is what it's telling me to do. And I love that because if I try to fix it all right away, exactly, it's going to explode in my face. I'm going to feel like a failure and it's going to set me back again. So this is why I love baby steps. And I can see in my life that they work because that's for me, that's how my recovery has been, a series of baby steps. And it is completely different today than when I came in this program. And I'm just so grateful for you guys. You've made my life a life worth living. I think I'm a really good mom now. Nowadays, I have an amazing daughter. I actually have friends in this program, people who I can call and talk about real stuff with. And that's such a blessing. Every day I'm on the WhatsApp chat and it's like, it's so inspirational because you guys really care. So I'm just so grateful. Thank you so much. And with that, I will share the time.